And we are extremely honored to have with us today our esteemed speaker, Rajiv Mehrotra. Welcome, Rajiv.
Thank
He
you.
is the author of the well-known book, Artificial Intelligence and the Future of Power. Artificial intelligence is only partially visible, just like an iceberg, and to understand it fully, we must look beneath the surface. Artificial intelligence and the future of power is a wake-up call to action, compelling public intellectuals to be better informed and more engaged. We certainly would encourage all of you to read his book if you have not to date. And he will also be speaking towards the end here of a new book that he is working on regarding integral yoga. We will be taking questions and answers the last 15 or 20 minutes, so please put them in the Q&A box. And with that, Rajiv, we'd like to go ahead and hand it over to you.
Namaste, everybody. Thank you for inviting me. Vladimir and I have known each other since the, I think, late 90s. And I did my foundation did a lot of projects in Pondicherry and Auroville on many fronts. And we've collaborated. Vladimir and I have collaborated on some of the works that we did. So I'm delighted when he called me some couple of years ago that he's moved to South Carolina, and we discussed ways of staying in touch more closely. And I'm very glad that he invited me to share my perspective on artificial intelligence. I would like to say that though I started my computer science grad school work in AI in the early 70s, 1970s, when I came to this country, I came as a physicist but switched to computer science. At that time, AI was sort of a fantasy, a dream. There was not enough hardware power to do what we can do today. There was not enough memory. There was not enough big data. There was not enough sophisticated machine learning, systems like neural networks and so on. So we were making progress, but very simple kind of things. But the philosophy was there, the metaphysics of what is AI, why do we need it, and what are some of the benchmarks, how to go about it. The theoretical foundations were being developed more than actual successful applications. But I kept in touch with it. And even when I had my own spiritual wake-up call in the mid-90s and decided to quit my tech work and join and start up my own a new kind of startup, Infinity Foundation as a spiritual exploration startup. Even so, throughout that, I kept in touch with AI, not as a professional, not as somebody who is actually involved in doing things in it, but as a person watching it, philosophizing about it, commenting on it, critiquing it, and so on. So, in that sense, this book, Artificial Intelligence and the Future of Power, Five Battlegrounds, this came out a few years ago. And at that time, people were not ready for it. It came out in 2018, but I started talking about it in 2015, 2016, so about 10 years ago, because I was concerned about several things. And it's very interesting when this book came out, India was very excited that the Jio network, which is Reliance's internet and their online presence and all that. Google has made an investment, and Facebook has made an investment, and they had a tie-up, and they will bring all these American AI type companies into India. I was against it because I said this will forestall a made in India AI technology. It will bring in the AI technology which has all the biases that these other people have, and I will talk about it. I will talk about the bias that AI has. Bias, which is somewhat sometimes intentional and sometimes unconscious, because if you look at how Google trains its machines, its AI algorithms, they're trained on New York Times and Washington Post and Wikipedia and the collected works of all kind of great Western thinkers. It's not trained on the works of Sri Aurobindo, for example. It's not trained on the works of Swami Vivekananda. It's not trained on our own rishis interpret views on life and Vedic thought and all that. It's not trained on those. It's trained on Western views of us and Western views of other things. Even the idea of ethics, even the idea of education, even the idea of social justice comes from somewhere else. So the colonization, we know the colonization project was to take over all the knowledge in knowledge disciplines and to put them into a Western framework, a European framework based on Europe's history and Europe, what Europe has experienced. That became kind of universal template. Nothing wrong with it for Europeans. They should understand their history and you know, make knowledge out of it. But they should also respect that Chinese have a different view of the world, and Vedic view is different, and Islamic view is different. And there are multiple worldviews that have to be respected. But Western universalism claimed that its knowledge of the world on all kind of fields is the superior one. And through the spread of English and through the education system, which they took over everywhere, and all the industries and jobs, they were able to spread Western ideology in all kind of ways. And so the literature that's out there, which is being used to train AI algorithms, is the same thing. We're trying so hard to decolonize, and now AI comes as a new recolonizing force. This is something I talk about in this book. Now, the subtitle is Five Battlegrounds. That's the byline here. So let me explain what they are, and then I'll focus on a few more detail. Battleground one is the sthul sharir, the physical body of humanity, external. It contains things like economy, industry, education, jobs, these kind of social dimensions, which are very important. And it talks about all the benefits that AI brings. You can have better agriculture, better medicine. You can have distance learning in education. But it also raises issues. The Industrial Revolution in England created the British Empire. There was no possibility of ruling over large parts of humanity had it not been for the Industrial Revolution. Because the Industrial Revolution gave them a manufacturing advantage. The factories, electrified factories, were more efficient, and they could do large-scale production, not so labor-intensive, and they could take over one industry after another, textiles, steel, blah, 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 all kind of industries, which used to belong to other countries. And India, because it was not allowed to industrialize, and the other country, Britain and France, did industrialize. So they became colonial powers. And the East India Company's success is because of the Industrial Revolution. Until then, it was just some small-time trading company. So when you consider AI as a revolution, it will also have a similar impact. So in this book, I ask, is Google the new East India Company? Can it have the power to decide, if it has the power to decide what you'll buy? Because after all, Google's services to you are free. All the search engine, the Gmail is free. But imagine, just think for a moment, the most popular services in the world, all over the place, are free. And yet those providers are the richest people in the world. So how does that happen? What is the magic that some people, they're so generous, so kind, so wonderful, so altruistic, that they're giving you all kinds of amazing things free, and yet somehow, mysteriously, they are the richest people in the world? Now, this ought to occur to any intelligent person, this question. And the simple answer is that while you are consuming these services, they are hacking your brain, your psychology, your behavior, what makes you tick, how you can be manipulated, how you can buy, how they can make you buy a particular brand of shoes, a particular airline ticket, a particular holiday, a particular, you know, whatever retail items you're buying. They can make you your behavior. They can modulate your behavior better than any other advertising, and they can get a commission on it. And that is worth trillions of dollars. So making the whole world behave in a manner that their sponsor, their advertiser, their client wants, and you know, is the secret for making so much money. So think of it this way. If there is so much power to get you to behave in your buying habits, what about your political voting habits? What about your spiritual allegiances? What about modulating what your religion is going to be? Or what is your thought system? Who you're going to date? What kind of lifestyle you're going to have? So all of that is also being hacked. So this is an important issue, that while they are very good at selling things, they're also very good in other ways. So the industrial revolution happened because a few people controlled all the factories, and now a few people control all the AI algorithms, the AI systems. We can say there's so many thousand AI startups in India, but they are using open source or they're using the platform supplied by American companies mostly. These platforms are not Indian. We don't even have an Indian operating system or our own email service or our own internet platform or our own social media. So the investment in AI, which has been made by these American gigantic companies, it gives them a control. They can set the knobs. They can control what is considered fake news according to their criteria, okay, and what is not, and who to deplatform. And if you speak in a way that they don't like, they can deplatform you. If they like you, they can boost you. So it's a game rigged. It's a game that is very exciting and tempting. Everybody can start their channel, everybody can start participating, but at the end of the day, somebody controls, has more controls over others. So in at the stool level, I'm predicting that this is going to be have the similar effects as the Industrial Revolution did in terms of creating gigantic corporations in the world, like the East India Company, that'll go across national boundaries, that'll have more political power than countries, because the East India Company came as a corporate company, not as a British government with troops invading India. Britain did not send troops of the from the government to invade India. A corporate entity muscled its way through nice finesse and understanding the behavior and making one guy fight another. They did all that and they built a big empire. Okay. So I feel that this AI and its control over the social media, its control over education policy, its ability to put a scandal here, to put some fake stuff, to even make some artificial videos and all that stuff, it's getting more and more serious. They'll have the ability to create empires. And not necessarily directly as their own in their own name, but through sepoys, through proxies. So they'll have that control capability. And I think the only people countering this American oligarchy, which is shaping up, are the Chinese. They're building their own equivalent, and they have banned the Americans in their country in order to encourage their own, which is something foolish India did not do. And also the Arabs. Now, Qatar has started its own AI system. Falcon is the name of their version of a chat GPT. And the Saudis have announced that they're going to do it. Those AI systems are going to be trained on Arabic texts, similar to like if we were to start an AI system and train it on Sanskrit texts. You see, so while India is just sort of consuming the American AI systems and building tools on top of an American platform. Maybe it's open source, but it's not our platform. And the fundamental training has not been done by us. That's why some of the AI systems I'm developing to promote and educate people about my works, my writings, Vedic knowledge, I'm finding that there's a lot of hallucination. Hallucination means that the AI system says something that we did not want it to say. We did not teach that. Where did it get it from? It's sort of like you have a young child, and this young child goes to a certain type of school during the day. Let's say one child goes to a madrasa, learns that ideology because they teach a certain way. Another one goes to a Catholic convent and learns their ideology. Another one goes to a Vedic pathshala and learns their ideology. Another one goes to a Maoist training camp. So these different children get a foundation differently from each other. And then the parents think that they're teaching the child. But sometimes the child says something that the parents say, "Hey, my God, where did he get it from?" Well, he got it from the other place, which is also educating him. So whatever we are doing on top of open source, some foundational biases already exist. Some foundational training has already been done. None of these things come with totally empty, because to train something from absolute scratch would take hundreds of millions of dollars of investment. I've gone through this exercise. It will take a large amount of money, which nobody has invested in India. So, this new gigantic AI revolution is going to create unequal outcomes. Some businesses, corporate entities will become the new oligarchs, the new empires. Some countries will do better, USA and China. You know, the old industrial revolution in the 1800s led to Britain and France becoming the two rival world powers, enemies with each other, but also competing over who gets to colonize this country or that country. They were fighting wars in India, British army and French army fighting wars in various parts of the world, in Africa, in India, in different places, to over control of territory. So I see the US and China as the two principal giants of this whole next age, will fight each other, but will also fight over who controls which territory. Does China control this country? The US control that country? And AI will be like the Industrial Revolution was in the 1800s. So this is my view of it. So I've talked about the battleground one, and I've also talked a little bit about battleground two, which is the geopolitics and military implications. So battleground one, which is about industry, jobs, etc. Battleground two, which is about geopolitics, military, are the sthul sharir, the physical world, and how it's going to be impacted. And I've just touched upon it a little bit. Battleground three is very interesting. I call it moronization of the masses. Moronization, which means turning the masses into morons, which means people who don't think for themselves, people who are on autopilot. They go in default mode and let the system decide. System decides when to go, where to go, what to eat. Maybe one day the robot will come and fill your refrigerator with the food that's quite best for you because we figured out what's good for you. And, so more and more free choice being surrendered. Surrendering your free choice. Surrendering this ability to think for yourself and make decisions. And this discern, this buddhi, giving up your buddhi and letting the algorithm have more buddhi over you because you trust it. So this is very good for in many ways, but also, your consciousness, rather than evolving, it atrophies. Rather than becoming more conscious, more alert, and expanding your ability to think for yourself, you are now just sort of going back and letting it make decisions for you. So I have used these, the terms I've used, digital deities. I've said there are digital deities being created. And I have a Google Devata and a Twitter Devata and Facebook Devata. They're sort of like the big Devatas that everybody has to make sure we are complying with their protocol. Otherwise, they may deplatform us and so on. So this dependency, the psychological dependency and the psychological emotional surrender to these systems is a major problem for me. And I don't see enough being done to counter that. There's many levels, even if say Ambanis were to control this, it's bad. Or Adani or Tatas, if they were to control this over Indians, it was bad. But at least they could be subject to regulation and accountability within India. Whereas when Zuckerberg controls the buttons of what will happen or somebody like that, you have multiple problems. Not only you have a problem where some person knows more about the technology than you do, and he can manipulate you and make a kind of a fool out of you, make a moron out of you, and you're just happily going along because you're getting all this free stuff and you're very excited about it. Not only that, but he's outside the jurisdiction where you have any authority, where you can get back to him, where you can regulate, where you can hold him accountable. These foreign-based oligarchs, taking over control of social media and politics and elections and, who will riot and what the news will say about this guy versus that guy and what will be manipulated and all that. This is very dangerous. And the Indian government and the Indian authorities are not doing enough about it. And I've been talking about it for 10 years. For 10 years, not only giving a lot of the early copies of this book to people in various places, to gurus, to media people, to government people, to military people, all kinds of people, but also giving short versions, giving them videos, giving them PowerPoints. The result is people are sort of waking up very slowly, okay? But the explosion of AI in India is only in the form of building, training human beings to become AI engineers and work for Google. become knowledgeable in AI, take a course, and work for Microsoft. Okay, so we are basically providing the coolies, the tech coolies, the AI coolies, to empower and further empower these foreign AI giants. We'll get good salaries, no problem. We may create a middle class, great. We'll bring some knowledge, fantastic. But the intellectual property being developed by these lakhs and lakhs of AI engineers in India does not belong to India. It belongs to whoever is the client. So even when they say that so many patents of AI have been filed in India, it's filed by Microsoft India and people like that, most of these patents. So you see, and the Indian companies are doing a good job starting. There are a lot of these unicorns and so on. I'm very proud of it, very happy about it. But they are building on top of a foundational layer, which they don't have, they don't control. See, so you could say that Android is open source. Android is open source. Yeah, everybody can just use it. But during the US-China trade war, in the Trump administration, US put a ban on Chinese use of Android as technology that cannot be exported. So China had to quickly come and develop their own operating system, which they did because they already had it ready. So all this open source also can come under control of a government. Or the open source, while anybody can use it, contains some biases. So I can create a biased, very subtle biased education system and give it away free. Say it's open source, you can sell it, you can market it, you can develop all the courses, you can teach it everywhere. It comes in 100 languages, all that stuff. It's open source, but it could also be a very sinister, subtle propaganda because I'm spreading my knowledge through that open source. So the real issue is that AI is not ideologically neutral. It is not, because it needs training. It needs to learn from experience, and the kind of experience that the trainers have had, the kind of experience the trainers want, is what feeds it. So if I have a certain point of view, and I were to go to Google and say, this is my view on the Aryan invasion theory, this is my view on the Varna Jati system, this is my view on consciousness, this is from my tradition, these are my views on various things, I can come up with a lot of things. And I want my views to be represented in your algorithms. And when you decide who is going to be banned and who is going to be shadow banned and what is bad news and what is fake news and all, I want my criteria. They're not going to be accepted because they have some guys sitting inside who know who's going to decide. I've been to Google headquarters, and they also told me that there is a Hindu group and a Muslim group and all kind of groups of different ideologies and different people. But and we have the option to make input, but none of our people are that organized, and none of our people have that much knowledge and confidence to take on the big Google and say, okay, this is what your algorithm is deciding, and it's wrong according to us. See, and even if there were very few people who had the knowledge, and they asked me to be an advisor to them and consultant off the record to give them advice, and I did. But then the issue comes that they don't have the confidence to stand up and say all this and face. It takes audacity. You have to fight your battle. So we just aren't organized, you see. So this battle of ideologies, the battle of grand narratives, is being fought via AI. AI is the force multiplier. AI is the mechanism that is going to amplify everybody's point of view through this AI. It is your way to present yourself in millions of places through this AI system, is this avatar with the footprint everywhere. And if you are smart about it, you can use it to expand your reach, okay, beyond any media code and so on. But to control your messaging is very important, and we don't have the tools in our own. We don't own the tools to do that. We're going to depend on somebody else's tools and somehow sneak our message in or convince them to accommodate us. And that's second class. That's not first class. You're not in the driver's seat. So this is a very important point facing the whole AI revolution right now. Battleground 4 is where I think the Sri Aurobindo people and the integral yoga, integral psychology people would be most interested. I call it the battle for self. The battle for self. It means who am I? Am I, and who am I? In what ways am I autonomous? In what ways am I, you know, my own adhyatma, my own inner being, versus being controlled and giving up that control because it's very tempting, it's very exciting. Now, you see, we talked a little bit already about the control that algorithms and AI systems exert upon you from the outside. But these are still external devices, like I'm sitting in front of a laptop. When I start wearing goggles, now it's even more close to me. Now I'm immersed in it. Now I'm moving around thinking that this guy is here, and I'm talking to him, I'm touching, I'm picking up this thing from the shelf in a store. I'm really involved, I'm immersed, and this world is a direct encounter between me and my environment. So I'm actually living a whole life in a metaverse, okay? And I could be living in it all the time, or much of my time. I could get entertainment, I could do my banking, I could do my shopping, I could have holidays. I could imagine I'm going to such and such place, having a holiday because I paid and bought it, but actually it's a virtual immersion experience. So that's the next level. But that's not enough. That's not close enough for them. Implants in the brain, which is real, which is coming. It's not just Elon Musk's company, but the Chinese are doing it. The Pentagon is doing it. There are just three or four major organizations. Again, it's a concentration of power that are developing these such that the implant is able to recognize a burst of neurons and say, this burst is happiness for this guy. This burst is sadness. This burst means he's angry. This pattern of neurons means he's likely to get violent. This burst means that the idea I gave he's happy with or not happy with. So being able to correlate the pattern of neuron activity with what are your emotions, what are your thoughts, what's likely to be happening, gives this ability, this thing, the ability not only to read what's happening, but also to influence it. Now, well, how will this be sold? It will be sold very nicely. It will get FDA approval and government approval and popular approval because the first application will be for your good. It will be able to look at patterns that predict heart attack. So it'll be good because, wow, we can tell if you're going to have a heart attack or if you're going to have a stroke or something like that, and health issue, and we're going to alert and get an ambulance and maybe, you know, inform your loved, your near and dear, your doctor. So we're going to save lives. And who would mind it? Who would mind it? Everybody would like it. Another application, maybe predicting a violent behavior. So there is a criminal and he's released now. And one condition of being released is he has to wear this thing so that if he's about to get violent or about to rape somebody or something, this thing will predict and alert and maybe get some help. It could also be for mental health. If somebody has a bipolar, then, you know, wearing this could be a good solution because if you're about to have a fit and about to do something wrong, maybe commit suicide, this thing will stop you. So medically, it could be very useful. In terms of crime control and behavior control and violence control, it could be very useful. In mental health management, it could be very useful. So these are the kind of applications which are good for everybody, under which the whole implanting technology will become popular. And who would not want it? Government might even require it. That, you know, if you are a violent person and we want to release you, one condition is that we have to monitor you. So this is how we're going to monitor you. So once the technology becomes accepted, then, you know, then other applications come. Like we can sell you entertainment, fantasy. You could have fantasy sex by having this kind of experience inside you. You could have a holiday. You could imagine that, you know, you're going down the Niagara Falls and there's all this water, this mist coming at you and this wind, and it's so exciting. It's like the real stuff. Or you're coming down on a parachute or something, and you're having that experience virtually. So this business of faking your senses, giving your senses an experience which is not actual stimulation from the external indriyas. It is like artificial indriyas that are giving you this experience. So this will be a great entertainment. And on and on and on. You could end up creating a generation where you can decide how happy they are, how sad they are, who gets pushed. I mean, you push a button and keep him happy all the time. So you will be able to create happy morons. And I use that, I explain that in this book, happy morons, which means the person is really not that smart, not that knowledgeable, not that involved in all these things, but he's full of himself. They've beefed up his ego and he thinks a lot about himself and they're keeping him happy. They're keeping him happy. And so this kind of a society, I predict a stage after that, which I don't want to get into. It's pretty, you need to read it for yourself, but I'm predicting what will this happy moron state of affairs lead to? What kind of a society are we heading toward? And then there is Battleground 5, which is specific to India and its policies and government and so on. So that's what the five battlegrounds are. Now, the important reason I wrote this book is because, as somebody who's worked with Sri Aurobindo, his thoughts on consciousness, and as a practitioner of meditation and trying to, do my best and raise my own consciousness and work with others and help each other in the spirit of Sri Aurobindo's teachings, I am very concerned that this AI-based movement is a counter movement. It's a movement which is going to empower behaviorism rather than meditation-based. Already, you have people going around saying that we can give you the same excitement, that same feeling of anand as meditation does, but without having to learn any meditation. The yogis took 20 years to achieve it, and now we can just put some brain stuff and give you the neuron pattern to give you that feeling without having to practice anything. So in a sense, this is a kind of a electronic version of drugs. LSD, when LSD came out in the 60s, LSD promised that you don't need to meditate, and this was the whole big opportunity for Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, who came from India, taught them TM, transcendental meditation, and the whole thing was, I can give you that feeling without having you having to take any drugs. So don't go to the route of drugs. Stop the drugs. I'll teach you how to meditate and give you that feeling. So there was a competition between the LSD, approach to feeling high and the TM approach. And it's taken 40, 50 years to educate the world, the Western world, and everywhere in the world that meditation is good for you. Okay? It takes some effort, takes some discipline, but it's good for you. Now comes AI, which is actually strengthening the hand of the behaviorism, the materialism, because to do this with AI, you don't need to know anything about Sri Aurobindo. You don't need to know anything about consciousness. You don't need to learn meditation. You just do it. Somebody pushes the button and you feel good. It's like taking LSD. Okay. But there's no molecules being injected in you. It's neurons being moved a certain way. It's neural LSD, if you will, okay, to produce a similar kind of an effect. So this is where I see there's a clash of civilizations. There's a clash between materialism and spirituality. And AI is right at the crossroads of that. Before AI, this is why I was monitoring AI for all these years, because I also wanted to make sure it's going in the right direction. And I'm not happy that my own fellow Vedic people, Aurobindonians, have not played a role, have not played a role. And the next book I'm writing is on the appropriation by Ken Wilber. Appropriation of Sri Aurobindo by Ken Wilber. It's a 500-page book. Vladimir helped me in the early days, way back. Vladimir knows that I've been working on this book since the 1990s. And I went to Auroville many times. I went to Pondicherry many times, gave many talks, tried to get help. But there was not much interest in help. People were lost in their own, whatever ideas they have or whatever they're trying to pursue. But they were not out there wanting to defend their guru, being appropriated, being distorted by Ken Wilber and his whole school of thought. So I started working on my own to do this, and I've spent 25 years. It will finally come out this year. It's a book which challenges the integral theory of Ken Wilber and from the Sri Aurobindo point of view. In doing so, It brings Aurobindo back into the debate, back into the global discussion. And what I really want to do is taking on Ken Wilber brings us in a position where we can then next take on the whole AI consciousness evolution movement. Will there be a Sri Aurobindo based, Sri Aurobindo ideas based consciousness movement of the future? Or will there be an AI with implants and with everybody, subdued into a nice moron, happy moron, feeling high, all that kind of stuff? That is, I think, where our generation is at. And I want to play a role in this. And I want to bring many of you along, invite you to collaborate. I will be writing a lot of stuff on this. So I think I have done my 40 minutes, I was told, discussion. We could go on for hours and days. Maybe someday we will. But I'm thanking all of you for listening and for those who invited me to come to give me the opportunity. And now I would love to answer your questions. Thank you very much, all of you.
Thank you so much, Rajiv, for such an enlightening talk on AI. I think, most of us are so overwhelmed because this field is going like lightning speed, and we either react by fear, right, or we react by being over-optimistic and really ignoring some of the threats and some of the concerns that you've mentioned today and that you mentioned in your book. And so it behooves us obviously to get more educated and as you've said in your book, to come to the table and address and acknowledge the issues. I guess from my perspective, and then I don't know how Vladimir's throat is holding up, but I'll also open it to him before the questions. From my perspective, the question I would have for you, Rajiv, is, you mentioned the power of Google, Microsoft, Amazon, Netflix, that we're giving over our freedom of choice. And we have already given over our freedom of choice. How do we take that back, or how do we reduce that surrendering of our power in the future? What is individuals like myself and others, what is our best course of action at this point?
So this is a wonderful question that you're asked. Let me just turn this off because it's going on disturbing me. So this is a wonderful question you've asked. The answer depends on the individual and where they are in their own inner being. And since you are a follower of Sri Aurobindo and you're a meditator, I'm sure. So I'm going to address it from your point of view. And I'm so happy that you've asked this question. I don't get enough opportunities to address people like you and people like this audience. That's my favorite. I want to talk to them. I feel that we need to adapt our meditation. We need to adapt our own evolution as meditators to a point where we can kind of position this external source, external thing, not let it get too much inside, but manage it, use it, get the benefit of it, but not let it take over my selfhood. Now that's something I'm working on for the last 5, 8 years as a meditator. Meditating, getting myself in a state where I know what the game is. I know that I'll control what I want out of it. Like I control my car. I know where to go and what to do, but I'm not going to let the car take over and drive itself. So similarly, using this AI consciously, making sure I understand the ramifications, I understand how much it is my slave. I don't want it to become its slave, but it should be basically material world that I can understand its algorithms, its behaviors, and make it do what's good for me, like we do with all other technologies. But being very conscious of that tipping point where it's just going to take over or cross over, and not letting that happen. This is not a theory only. This is an actual experiential practice, and I'm developing. When my book comes out, on this the next book comes out, I want to actually work with you guys or whoever is interested in this kind of a thing and turning it into an education program. But I'm developing this on myself. I'm developing this on myself. I'm subjecting myself to a lot of, let's just say, hacking risks, hijacking risks from the outside, and being able to figure out how to have enough enough consciousness of my own that I can use it when I want to, but I won't let it use me. I think this way, this kind of an education, if we were to add to our children, we were to add to our policymakers, we would add to our leaders, you know, teachers and spiritualists, it would really create a world where we can have the best of both, in the sense that we can benefit from this technology where it's useful, but we are never going to allow it to take over. I think that does not exist. The problem I'm finding is, you know, and I'm so glad that you've asked this question. The problem I'm finding is, I've heard, and I don't want to get in trouble with gurus, you know, but I've heard a very well-known guru in the South who's famous all over the world. I don't, you know, if I name it, just creates more problems. And he goes around and giving talks, and he's invited by scientists and by AI people. And their knowledge of this issue is so limited. So limited. They're so naive. I mean, they're just making very politically correct, simplistic statements. Everybody is very happy with them. But they really do not understand the system in detail. So they don't know what the risk is and how to deal with it. I feel that we need to first educate our own leaders, both in policymaking, in education, in spirituality. And we then need to take it from there, because they all have a lot of influence. They are force multipliers, just like AI. And we have to balance out the AI power.
Wonderful, wonderful. Thank you. Thank you for that that hope for us, at least those that are followers of Integral Yoga, and hopefully others in the world. I will, before we go to Q&A, Vladimir, I don't know how you're feeling, but would you like to say anything?
Yes, small. I'm very glad that you actually clarified this point of view, where we can have both, yes. Because Sri Aurobindo speaks about this, and the mother also, and pre-Vedic, pre-Chaldean tradition, which was one long ago, when the spirit and matter were seen as one enterprise, yes? And then in due course, they split. And so the Semitic tradition started that power trend, and materialistic development of the West, and taking power from the physical and vital nature. And in the East, they had to go, in India especially, towards the spirit forgetting nature, slowly becoming Advaitic. And now there is a time to come back. We should not lose ourselves. I'm so glad that you brought these two together, because one is not solution, neither of these. So both are to be there. And we can benefit from AI as a tool, but we don't need to submit ourselves to it. You know, so that's my take from you. Thank you. Thank you, Rajiv, for this.
Thank you. Thank you, Vladimir. You know, you see, the thing is that the option of rejecting AI is not an option in practice. We can't do it. I mean, if you and I and all 100 of us who are watching, participating in this webinar, and the rest of people who are on board, even if we want to, I mean, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, the point is it's not within our power. It will happen. That's the nature of technology. That's the nature of supplying the world with goodies, which are very, you know, good for the ego, which everybody wants. People are lazy, they're tamasic, they want more than they can produce on their own, and they want something else to do the work. And now here comes AI to do the work for us. So this laziness and this tamas is going to make AI very successful, and the people will be very rich. The question is, can we have a more awakened, not a tamasic, but have a more awakened, you know, engagement with this from people who understand this much better, the whole relationship of spirit and matter, and why one subduing the other long term is not going to work, because they're both part of reality anyway. So wonderful. So let's have some more questions.
And I'm just going to, there's several questions here, but two of them are how can we collaborate with you is one of the questions, and the related one, how can we help you in this endeavor? So people are very impressed with what you have to say and the work that you've been doing and would love to support and participate.
So this is wonderful. It's music to my ears. If it's genuine and sincere, I invite you. And so rather you could put in my email address. My email address are just for those. I can Rajiv Malhotra, RajivMalhotra, 2007. Rajivmalhotra 2007 at gmail.com. I'm also on Twitter at Rajiv Message. You can follow me. And I'm on YouTube, Rajiv Malhotra.official. That's the name, rajivmalhotra.official or infinityfoundation.official. My website is rajivmalhotra.com. All my books are there and all kind of stuff. But if you, just so you know, I was a tech guy and I came and became a computer type person and all of that, from physics to computers to technology. And then I had a spiritual moment, my own spiritual moment, when I was in my early 40s. This was in the 1990s. And then this transformation led me to sort of give up this for-profit profession, rat race, running around. I suddenly gave it up, absolute abandoned it overnight, and then I never looked back. I've never gone back, and people thought I'm crazy. I was crazy. Even now they think I was crazy. But anyway, I pursued this pursuit of mine, where being a meditator from childhood, being having read the Life Divine and many other things of Sri Aurobindo, very interested in all that, and also being a physicist and a computer scientist, and from that point of view, I wanted to explore all of these things. And so I've been doing that full time for 30 years. I have no job or no other thing. Nothing has to do. This is what I do 7 days a week. So I'm into this in a very serious way. So I want to collaborate only with those who are very serious. I mean, a lot of people come and they have opinion of this and that. And I could sit all day long and listen to different opinions. I've heard them before. Those are nothing new. So I don't want people who are just sort of going to drain the time. If you have something serious you could do, and you want to write to me saying, this is my background, very short, this is my background, this is what my resources are, what I'm able to do, this is what I can offer you. So I'm looking for people who can give resources, people who are, if you are a good writer, I'm looking for people who can help me finish my books, because I have all the knowledge, I've dictated it, I've got drafts, but I need some people to help me. We can even pay people as research assistants or as writing assistants to, so I can get more books out faster. I have 20 books incomplete. I have 13 books that are out already in the last 15 years. I have about three or four that will more be out this year, and I have 20 more yet to do, which are like 95% done. This book, which I'm going to produce, which is about Ken Wilber, hijacking Sri Aurobindo, Vladimir knows that I've been working on it since the 90s, because he's been part of this. I've been talking to him and talking to a lot of people. So like this, my 20 volumes are all sort of working for many, many decades, but they need to come out. And I want to make them perfect and bring them out. So I'm looking for help. And that means that you have to be somebody good at it. You can't be somebody who says, look, I would like to help you, but I don't know. Teach me. So I can't teach people at this stage. You have to be talented. You have to have a good organized mind and writing skills. So if you want to send me, you're saying, okay, here's a writing sample. This is what I've done. I'd love to work with you. I'm very interested. On the other hand, if you are somebody else, like not a scholar, not a writer type, but somebody who says, okay, I want to organize talks. I want to organize, how to take this knowledge, how to take this kind of a knowledge and turn it into an e-learning course. I would love to do that. How to turn it into something that can, not everybody is going to read, 500 pages. Although we do have summaries in every chapter, you can read the introduction and the summaries and you'll get a lot of the knowledge. But still, there are different ways to help me propagate this knowledge. So I'm pretty much a one-man show. I have a nonprofit foundation. We do seek funding because I'm training young scholars in India. I have about 15 of them, and we pay them, and they're full-time working with us. And I'm training them to replace me so that one day when I'm gone, they can take over. I don't want this whole thing to collapse. So we are training. Intellectual kshatriyas, we call them intellectual kshatriyas. So they are intellectuals and they'll stand up for a certain value system. They'll stand up for, their ideas and counter counter this new East India Company and counter the Google Devatas, you know, and so on. So they have to be both courageous and intelligent, and they have to, of course, be meditators. So there's many ways people can help me, but only if you are really sure and really confident and really committed and have something to offer, do connect with me. I'll be most interested.
Wonderful, wonderful. And I did put Rajiv's email there in the chat in case you didn't get it. Santosh, a question from Santosh. It seems the fundamental problem lies is how to purify the mind for the people to see the truth towards pure peace, love, and joy. Has there been any effort to help see the value of purity at the top levels of AI oligarchy in the US or elsewhere? I believe their leadership can also be transformed to see the merit of holistic growth and development of humanity. It's also true that some of the CEOs of the top AI organizations are Indians. If there has been any efforts, what have been the outcomes? And I think you
excellent
touched on
question.
This a little bit.
Excellent question. I have gone, and I don't want to mention names of these Indians, I have gone and met some of these, tried to get there. But, you know, there's a private life and then there's a public life. In the private life, they may be very compliant. They give money to some temple. They have a puja at a house, all that stuff. But when it comes to work, they are into, you know, serving. They're serving the boss. Who, they're not the owners. They're CEO type people. They're worth a lot of money. But at the end of the day, they're working for someone else. And they are following what, even when I pointed out that your Facebook, your Microsoft algorithm, your Google has this flaw against your tradition. It has this bias about your own tradition. It's like, hey, you know, I'm not going to go there, that kind of a thing. So if I say too much of it, they'll just sort of cancel you and not talk to you again. And this is a shame. This is a shame because I made money too, but teeny bit compared to these guys. It was enough for me. I know that you should have enough, but not more than enough. I didn't want to make more than enough. I wanted to make enough. And having done that, I said, you know, life is more than just getting, making more and more, adding more zeros at the end of your net worth. I could have easily made 100 times more than I had at that time because the technology I was in was exploding. And I could have just stayed there another 10 years and be worth a lot. But I didn't want to do that because I would miss a bigger chance. I would miss a chance to evolve myself and learn all these things. I'm trying to get these guys excited that you got so much money, it'll last you for 100 generations, whatever it lasts you. You don't need to make more. But you know, that spiritual awakening only happens to some lucky few, and I'm very grateful. You know, unless they have their own awakening, unless that inner spark is there, I mean, you can give all the logic you want. And they understand logically that they got 100 times more money than they'll ever spend. They know that. And they would be better just getting rid of all that and turning their life into something else. But they're not going to do that. So you see, this is the problem. This is the problem of success in the material world is important. If you can not depend on the success and become a slave to keep having more and more, but you can satisfy your needs and say, I'm satisfied. I've done it all. I've had the fun and the pleasures. I've owned this and that and done it all. Now I'm beyond that. I want to go beyond that. If you can do that, you're very lucky. Very few of them are like that. So this is my situation. The top-down view, which is what you are promoting, I have tried and will continue trying because maybe somebody somewhere will have this breakthrough. I've even tried with some of the Indian billionaires that, you know, you should invest your... I've created a project called a Sanskrit Large Language Model. Sanskrit Large Language Model. It's very amazing amount of uniqueness in Sanskrit that would be captured in this large language model. And then our equivalent of a ChatGPT would be so grounded in the fundamental categories of our thought. But it'll be a huge investment. And I have all this business plan on, you know, how many people we need to do this training, to do this tagging, whatever, all that kind of stuff, to do the vectorization of Sanskrit texts and all. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of work and it's a lot of money. And I've even approached some of the billionaires and said, you know, this would be your gift to the future of the world if you were to do that. And it'll only cost you a fraction of all these hundreds of billions or whatever you own. But I haven't found one yet who's willing to say, okay, let's get started. I mean, people, they always look for, okay, what's in it for me kind of thing. And maybe It'll make me famous with the Prime Minister. Maybe I'll get some Padma Award. Maybe I'll get some Rajya Sabha seat. And they're always looking for that, you know. And I can't offer that. I'm not interested in any of that. So what I offer is genuine spiritual transformation, individually, collectively, for the whole humanity. And that requires a commitment from the other side, a scale of investment, a scale of altruism. It only will happen once enough individuals are personally having that experience. It's not a logic. It's not about somebody come and this clever Rajiv fellow has argued and convinced me. No way. It has to be that they have to feel that. They have to feel that.
We have one last question here from Jody. I am a professor of AI ethics in Canada. I teach AI ethics to the master's level students in Canada who are building AI and analytics. What are the three things you would want to recommend to me that must be covered in the course?
Well, you should write to me, and I have a whole my AI manifesto, which I haven't published, but I can discuss with you offline. You see, data ownership of the individual whose data it is has not been adequately covered by all these privacy laws. So, for instance, if you anonymize my data, you are still stealing it. You are not saying it's Rajiv. You are just saying there's some man of this age and this kind of group and profile. He lives here and there. This is about him. And you are using it to come up with your behavior algorithms. Sorry. But you are still not respecting that you're taking my data, ignoring my name, making it anonymous, and then you're saying we can get away with it. That's not good. So I think that the ethics requirements and policies don't go enough. Secondly, I have some ideas, some architectures to build AI systems that will actually detect AI biases. So I can use AI against AI. And again, that's a project. It requires serious funding and backing, and I haven't been able to get people who are willing to do that. So the idea is basically that just like AI can control the whole ecosystem of a social media against whatever its values have been trained, whatever biases it has, so also we can train an AI to look at what the behavior is of a certain network, of a certain writer, of a certain university, of a certain institution, and look at it for biases and rate it. And I would love to be able to do that. So my ideas are more sort of creating new systems. Of course, in what you are doing is very important, which is you are training individuals to have more ethics. I am looking at it, what are the systems that we can develop that can make AI more ethical. But as an individual, getting them into a meditation program with the idea that my inner life, my inner being, my adhyatmic life is superior and more important to me for my evolution than all this external stuff, which is a game I'm playing also. I'm fine with it. But the inner evolution, it takes preference and is privileged, it takes priority. Getting them on that track will keep them honest. Will keep them honest, because when they're making a call, a policy decision or some judgment, they have to stop at the, you know, rather than a calculation of the ego saying, okay, risk, reward, I can do this, get away with it, make more money this way or that way. No, they have to also look at it from a consciousness point of view. And if they have evolved that, it's not about logic, it's about evolution. If they have evolved that, then they will be better prepared to be able to say no, even if the stand being taken is unpopular, even if it is risky, even if you're giving away opportunity. But you have to be able to do that.